Welcome to the Richard Roper Podcast. I am Richard Roper. Thanks to everyone who has been joining us. These many days, weeks, months, years, you want to name it on the calendar. You guys have been there for me. I appreciate that. Tons of stuff going on in the world of pop culture. We're going to talk about some breaking news, some entertainment news. I hope we can get to some reviews, but sometimes we just get so worked up about all this other stuff, we never get to the reviews, but we're going to try. So let's get right to it. First of all, here's your reminder. The Richard Roper Show is brought to you by AmericanEagle.com Studios. The digital landscape is changing rapidly, and to compete in today's online business environment, you need an experienced partner. Since 1995, AmericanEagle.com has partnered with companies of all sizes, offering web design, web development, e-commerce, mobile apps, and digital marketing to drive your overall business's success, because they believe that today's online world is your online opportunity. Visit AmericanEagle.com today, AmericanEagle.com. That's AmericanEagle.com. And thanks to everybody at American Eagle who has helped me with this. My man, Brian, doing all the heavy producing work. Renee, everybody else at American Eagle. We appreciate you guys. By the way, these are the live reads. I've been doing these since I was doing good old-fashioned terrestrial radio back way back in the day. It's all on the computer screen, but I like to have that paper. I like to have that paper going. All right. I want to lead just by talking very quickly about O.J. Simpson. And by the time you guys are hearing this podcast, it'll be close to a week since O.J. Simpson passed away. There's been a lot of talk about the trial, about how it affected the media. You know, in the early and mid-90s, we had this explosion of kind of tabloid media, various talk shows that kind of trafficked in tawdry material. Tons of scandals and trials that got a lot of play. And of course, the fact that the O.J. Simpson trial, first of all, the O.J. Simpson case played out in real time, though. The infamous white Bronco chase, all the madness surrounding that. Even when the news broke that his ex-wife, Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman had been viciously attacked and murdered, the idea at the outset that O.J. Simpson would be involved in this seemed kind of crazy to America, because he was a beloved football hero and then a commercial spokesperson, and then, you know, did those comedies and even dramatic movies. But then the trial itself was televised and became this huge circus, and all these sort of pseudo instant celebrities emerged from Kato Kaelin, who was staying in the guest house at O.J. Simpson's estate, and Faye Resnick, who was Nicole Brown's friend, and even you know, the attorneys. Now, we knew some of the attorneys were quite famous, F. Lee Bailey and Johnny Cochran. Then, of course, you had Robert Kardashian, the father of the Kardashians, of course, and all sorts of, even Judge Ito became quite famous. I want to just say this in terms of what we talk about mostly on this show. I'm not going to rehash all the things at this trial, the ripple effect. I wrote hundreds of columns and pieces. I covered this extensively back in the 90s as a news columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Went out there a few times, did interviews with some of the people, some of the principals involved in the case. It's interesting to see, you know, there's a whole generation of people that weren't around and don't remember everything about the case. I will say this. Been watching OJ Made in America, which is the 5-part documentary series. I think you can get it on Netflix right now and some other platforms. There are a lot of great fictionalized versions. There are tons of stories about the case, the People versus OJ, books you can read. But OJ Made in America, the 5-part documentary series, is what I would recommend to folks. It does an amazing job of really chronicling the case. A lot of interviews with some of the major participants. Going back on this, listen, I'm 101%, if you can be 101% convinced of anything, that O.J. Simpson is guilty. To me, there was never any doubt about that. But I want to say something a little bit in defense of the jury, which has been maligned for 30 years. You know, this was a very extensive case with tens of thousands of pages of transcripts and hours and hours and hours of testimony. It went on for like 260-plus days, and then they deliberated for 3 hours before returning the verdict of not guilty, which shocked a lot of people and also, you know, gave a lot of people cause for celebration. The case became about so much more than whether or not O.J. Simpson murdered those two poor innocent victims. It became a referendum, if you will, on racial relations, on the court system in America. And a lot of the jurors have said that they felt this was payback for Rodney King, which is the wrong way to base your decision, of course. The judge did, you know, instruct the jurors, you have to take emotions out of this. That was never going to happen. But to the point of the 3 hours or 4 hours or whatever it was of deliberations, they had had 260 some days to go back to their hotel rooms. They were sequestered. Now, they couldn't talk with each other, but I think the jurors had all made up their minds long before closing arguments. The other thing is, in terms of the case itself, I have to say this, the prosecution bungled that case in so many ways that you could actually make an argument, even though, again, I'm convinced O.J. Simpson did it. The way they handled that case, I mean, talk about grounds for appeal if he had been found guilty. But, you know, first of all, they didn't vet Mark Furman. They had no idea, I don't think, about his past and how that would work against them. Christopher Darden's monumental mistake of having O.J. try on the gloves, even though Marcia Clark and others on the prosecution team had said, don't do that. Never ask a question or ask for something to happen in court that you don't know the answer to. And then O.J., because he had the latex on, he did all the drama. The gloves could have fit him just fine. And then I don't know, there were so many weird things that happened in the case, including the visit, the field trip that the jurors made, along with the lawyers and, of course, police escort, et cetera, to O.J. Simpson's home in Brentwood. And they actually went inside the home for this tour, which had nothing to do with this case, occurred in that home. There was a glove that was found outside in that little alleyway, blood on the car. But inside the house, nothing, there was never any allegations about anything happening the night of the murders inside that house. And what you'll see in this documentary, it's incredible, is that they actually changed the decor in the house to make OJ appear to be, for lack of a better term, more black, put in African-American art. They changed out the pictures on the staircase so that all of the photos, or most of the photos, were OJ with fellow black celebrities and black family members, and got rid of all of it. And they even put up artwork from Johnny Cochran's office at the top of the staircase. I mean, just incredible stuff. It's a fascinating documentary. It's in the top 10 right now on Netflix as we speak. And I do highly recommend OJ Made in America. Okay. Orange juice time. I did not plan that. Okay. Just had a sip of orange juice for those of you listening. I do want to mention Taylor Swift. You may have heard of her. She's a pop singer. She's fairly popular. She has released, of course, what's it called? The Dead Poets Society. You're a Poet to Me. The Tortured Poets Department. You guys know what I'm talking about. Just want to tell a personal story here. I'm in Chicago, as a lot of you folks know. And in Chicago, a few days before the release of Taylor Swift's double album, there's a building in what we call the River North area, which is only a few blocks from where I live. And their painters were putting up this this QR code, this giant QR code. And then it had her name, and fans started flocking there, right, to check this out. Because if you pointed your phone or your camera at the QR mural, it would then take you to some Easter eggs teasing the album. Clever way to market it. And they only, as far as I know, they only did this in Chicago. So it got national, international play. I walked over there with my smartphone, took a little video of this QR code. And as we speak, it has more than 600,000 views on Instagram, tens of thousands more on other platforms. Incredible. Just a little 20-second video. But the fans were figuring out the Swifties. I think that's what they call them, Swifties, right? The Swifties had figured out they could even just point their camera at my video and they could capture that QR thing. One of the interesting things to me, though, not surprising, I will say, I was not surprised by this, but it was interesting to me, was the comments that started flooding in. I had more than 5,000 comments. I turned the comments off. I'm going to preface this by saying you're not going to see these comments. A lot of them were just Swift fans saying, oh, this is cool. Where is this? Thanks for doing this. You know, hey, point your phone at the QR code. And then you started getting the political fallout, which you'll always do with almost any post, but especially anything to do with the pop culture, with a huge celebrity who's considered to be either conservative or, in Taylor Swift's case, I think pretty progressive, pretty liberal, she'd been pretty clear about that. And all these MAGA started jumping in. Oh, you're in a cult. It's pathetic that you people are out there on a Thursday or whatever it was, Wednesday morning, you know, shooting video and gathering because you want to look up at a mural. You know, my feeling is this. First of all, when I went out there, the vast majority of the crowd that was out there checking out this Taylor Swift mural were young people, people in their teens, 20s and 30s, mostly women, but good sprinkling. But they're, you know, so first of all, these are people that probably age of college students, or, you know, maybe they're working, but, you know, you take a 15-minute break, or maybe you drive in from the suburbs. What's wrong with that? The idea, this thing to say, oh, it's a cult, you know, that comes from people saying that about Trump, let's be honest. I think there's a huge difference between being an ardent fan of a pop music star and really getting excited about the release of a double album or a little, you know, advertising Easter eggs and things like that. Big difference between that and buying into a serial liar, a sociopath, a narcissist who is on trial as we speak and has other, you know, legal problems, shall we say, and was an election denier, was a birther. I think there's a huge difference between those so-called followings or cults. So, and the other thing, and I did mention this in an Instagram post, if you're a grown adult going after teenage fans of Taylor Swift, it says more about you than it does about them. Let's be honest, okay? Regardless, listen, I think Taylor Swift's very talented. I'm not interested in, you know, dissecting every song and all of that. I like listening to some of her stuff. It's not meant for me. But I think every generation, we have our moments where we get super excited. Listen, there's a lot of people getting really excited, you know, to go see Billy Joel's concerts at Madison Square Garden recently, or Phish playing at the Sphere, the cool Sphere in Vegas, and U2 is there. I know that I get excited still to this day about certain acts coming to Chicago. But, you know, when you're 15, when you're 17, when you're in that zone, you feel a certain passion for music that you may never, even if you love music, there's a certain, you know, connection you have because the songs speak to you. So your parents or grandparents can probably tell you about how much Elvis or Frank Sinatra meant to them. I know my parents, my grandparents, if you go even further back, you know, they were really into big band music and jazz. And then when I was coming up, it was all about Beatles were a little before my time, but I was a huge fan of Stevie Wonder and a lot of, you know, Led Zeppelin and all the 70s bands. I remember, you know, some of the first concerts I saw were, you know, Fleetwood Mac, Heart, who, by the way, are back on tour. And you get excited about it. And yeah, you wait in line sometimes to buy the latest album, or you scrape together as much money of, you know, you can from your first part-time job or your allowance or your Christmas or birthday or whatever money so that you can go see a concert or buy an album. And to me, it's all completely harmless. And Taylor Swift is now to the point where, you know, she's had a career for what, a decade and a half now. So she's not a fat, folks. Far from it. She's a superstar and she's going to have a long career, just like Barbara Streisand and just like, a you know, 100 other artists who well into their 50s, 60s, 70s keep making music and keep, you know, drawing crowds to, now they have a lot of these Vegas residencies. But that being said, a lot of the kids, if you will, who are Swifties right now, yeah, there's going to be a time where they're not as excited about the latest Taylor Swift album, or they're not going to go out and look at, you know, take photos of a QR code because they're going to have life. They're going to have college and they're going to have jobs and they're going to have families maybe and responsibilities. That's just the way life goes. Everybody relax. I knew this was going to happen. We're never going to get two reviews today. We'll do it next week, I promise you, because I got a bunch of other stuff I want to talk about, but I have to. Where's my live read? I have to tell you guys about Portillo's. We're going to talk about Portillo's right now. Let me tell you about our friends at Portillo's, the finest fast casual experience you're going to have in all of dining. Portillo's, not just the hot dogs that everybody knows about when it started in Chicago, but they got the Italian beef. They got the Italian sausage. You got to say it like that. And of course, the famous chocolate cake. And remember the rule, at least the standard practice, is you do not refrigerate the chocolate cake. You just have it as it comes, room temperature. Now they've got Portillo's in California and Arizona and Florida, other places across the country. They're getting bigger and bigger. There's so many great things you can get at Portillo's. They have that bun. They put the Italian beef. Then you can get it dipped and it gets all wet. Of course, the perfect slice of bread. All of this stuff and more. I tell you, you know, talk about the hot dogs and the Polish sausage, the hamburger from Portillo's, guys, and the onion rings. Unbelievable. There's a Portillo's. We were just talking about the Taylor Swift QR code. There's a Portillo's just a few blocks from that. And especially when the weather's nice in Chicago, they actually have young people out there with headsets on the street, on Clark Street, taking your order so that they can move the cars quickly and efficiently through the drive-thru. That's how crowded and popular it is. Okay, go to portillos.com. P-O-R-T-I-L-L-O-S is how you spell that, portillos.com. You can find a store near you or online anywhere and get it right here in these United States of America, portillos.com. You know, just real quick about the Taylor Swift thing. It's a double album. People are like, oh my gosh, it's a double album. That's so much material. And that's very cool. Again, going back to the day in the 60s and the 70s, that was a pretty common thing. And I put a list together of some of my favorite. Leonard Bernstein, who was just, you might have heard of Bradley Cooper, did a movie where he played him, wrote it and directed it and produced it and all that stuff. He did tons of double albums. Those are probably the first double albums I saw in my house as a kid growing up, the actual double vinyl album. Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde was huge. The Who with Tommy, Elton John, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road was a favorite. Led Zeppelin, Physical Graffiti. The Rolling Stones, of course, did Exile on Main Street. One of my favorites was Stevie Wonder, Songs in the Key of Life. It was really cool with these concept albums. Prince did Sign of the Times later on. Wu-Tang, I know, did one. I think Tupac was one of the first solo hip-hop artists to do a double album. And, you know, the thing for the artists then, these albums were, and there were even triple albums. Yes, I think Yes Songs it might have been. Like, you guys will correct me if I'm wrong on that. But the prog rock group, Yes, one of my favorite bands, partially because they were local, but also I just love the fact that they used rock and roll along with horns. Chicago, they did CTA, Chicago Transit Authority was their first album. They did double albums, and then they even did a fourple album, a quadruple album, live at Carnegie Hall. But especially not so much with the live albums. The live albums were cool, but these other albums we talked about, these concept albums going all the way up to Taylor Swift, the cool thing was they were meant to be listened to in order. I know a lot of people now just do the shuffling. And when we talk about Taylor Swift double album, I mean, most people are just downloading it, right? But the idea that you should listen to it in order, just like you should listen to, you know, I mentioned The Who's Tommy, which was a concept album, which of course became a Broadway production. And then a movie, Jesus Christ Superstar. Any of those are, of course, meant to be heard in order. But even the classic rock, the soul, the R&B, the hip hop, there was a whole story thread going through a lot of those. So I always loved the double albums. All right, switching gears. Anne Hathaway, who was in Les Mis, but I don't think has ever done a double album of her own. But this is a story that caught my eye. You might have heard about this. Anne Hathaway. Of course, you know, she's done a lot of romantic films, Love and Other Drugs with Jake Gyllenhaal, the Princess Diaries movies. She's got a new movie coming out called The Idea of You. I'll have a review of that. I promise I'll get to reviews next podcast. I promise I will. Maybe we'll just do an all review podcast to make up for this. But a new interview with V Magazine, Anne Hathaway says that back in the 2000s, it was considered normal to ask an actor to make out with other actors to test for chemistry. And she said, this is actually the worst way to do it. I have to be honest. I'm pretty familiar with how they cast films and all of that. I was a little taken aback. I know that there have been some choreographed rehearsals and certainly, I guess, some casting decisions. But in this case, Anne Hathaway said they had her make out with like a dozen different guys. And she thought it was so gross. She said, I was young. I didn't want to be labeled as difficult. She said no one was trying to be awful or hurt me. It was just a very different time, and now we know better. Well, yeah, there are ways to find out if people have chemistry without having them, you know, make out. And the idea, I mean, when I hear about this, and I don't mean to make light of it, because to me it's like, God, it'd be such a strange thing to do to just make out with a series of strangers. I think they call that The Bachelor now, right? I mean, even that. I love the cheesy slickness of The Bachelor and The Bachelorette, The Golden Bachelor, and we send our thoughts and prayers to The Golden Bachelor and Mrs. Golden, because they get divorced after, what, 3 months? But it's kind of weird even on those shows when you see, you know, the same person. I'm not trying to be a prude, but it's just like in real life, if you made out with somebody 10 times in one day, that different people, I should say, that's crazy stuff. So, yeah, I can't imagine that flying today. I think that's one sign of progress. Another story that's making the rounds, this one has to do, did you see this thing with Alec Baldwin? You know, Alec Baldwin, you know, he's a great actor, interesting guy, very smart. We know, you know, his many troubles have been well documented with the paparazzi and encounters, and of course the horrible tragedy on the set of the movie Rust. We've been through all of that. But in this latest story, you might have seen the video. We'll play a little. Let's play a little audio of this here. This is I don't know what you want to call this person, a TikTok influencer or social media ambush person, ambushing Alec Baldwin in a coffee shop.
Alec, can you please stay free Palestine one time? Why did you kill that lady? You killed that lady and got no jail time? No jail time, Alec?
I'm sorry.
No jail time, Alec. You're putting innocent people in jail, Alec Baldwin.
I'm so sorry.
Free Palestine, Alec, just one time, and I'll leave you alone. I'll leave you alone, I swear. Just say free Palestine one time. One time. One time. One time, Alec. You know he's a criminal. You know he's a criminal. Come on, Alec, just say free Palestine one time. One time, just one time, please. And I'll leave you alone. Free Palestine. Israel, Zionism. Please say it. One time.
So, you know, Alec Baldwin's just trying to get coffee. He's on the phone. This person keeps saying, you know, wanting him to say free Palestine, wanting him to comment on the death of the late cinematographer, Helena Hutchins, who died on the set of the Western film that, gosh, I can't believe that was 3 years ago already. It's to me. And then she says, oh, the white devil, Alec Baldwin attacked me. Well, that's not what happened. He did grab her phone. And again, you wish you hadn't, but you certainly can understand that. This idea, this person describes themselves as an ambush interviewer. That's what they do. You can see this individual on the social media. And that's the idea, you know, come up to people, whether they're public figures or not, and ambush them. I hate that shit. I hate that anybody doing that stuff. It's like the prank videos you see where somebody pretends to be robbing someone at an ATM or stuff like that. And then they see how people react. And then sometimes they get the crap beat out of them. And you're like, well, what do you think was going to happen? But in this case, it's like nobody attacked you. You accosted him. Again, yes, he probably shouldn't have grabbed your phone from you and all of that stuff, but it's certainly understandable. Nothing, there's no entertainment value in this for, first of all, this ambush idea, like, oh, wow, I'm some sort of a journalist. No, you're not. And you're not an entertainer. You're just an awful human being who will do anything for clicks. And now I guess this person got what they wanted. There's all this publicity about this. This is why I'm not mentioning them by name, but I hate that shit when, you know, listen, even if you see somebody you strongly disagree with, I'm all for protest. I think the stuff at Columbia is way, way extreme and over the top and dangerous. I think going to the homes, even of elected officials and protesting is wrong. I think accosting people when they're having dinner, again, even if you strongly disagree with them, especially when they're with children or their spouses, nothing ever gets accomplished by that other than more divisiveness, more hatred. And then you get to say, oh, look, I caused a stir. Look at me. Well, people are looking at you and they're thinking you're an asshole. Okay. You know what? We got a couple of minutes. So I'm going to backtrack on my backtrack and let's do a couple of quick reviews.
This Friday, one of the sexiest movies ever made arrives.
Mommy, come tuck you in.
Critics are calling Challengers fierce, electrifying, and deliriously enjoyable.
So, how often does this happen? Going after the same girl?
This is Zendaya like you've never seen her before.
Come on!
Rated R, only in theaters Friday.
I wanted to mention Challengers. Of course, you guys have heard a lot about Challengers. The tennis movie, the tennis à trois, if you will. This has got Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, and Mike Faist. We have to say all three of them, incredibly good looking people. They're all playing tennis players and we catch them when they're in their late teens and then about 13 years later. And it's all about this romance that goes back and forth. I think this is one of the best tennis movies of all time. And when I talk about tennis movies, I'm not just talking about something like Match Point, which has that element, but I'm talking about Final Set, Battle of the Sexes, King Richard, Wimbledon, films in which tennis is, you know, a central part of it. It certainly is here. And they've marketed this as a very sexy movie, and it is, but I have to say the sex scenes are kind of tame, relatively tame. They're steamy enough, but they're not crazy because it's really more about, using sex in some cases as a weapon. It's a competitive thing. Zendaya's character is, very manipulative with these two guys. She ends up with one of the guys for a while and then marries another one. And then years later, they all three lives intersect at this kind of second tier challengers, is what they call it on the tennis tour. That's kind of the second level. And there's a reason why, even though one of them is a champ and one of them is not, that they're playing in that. So the tennis is really interesting. The dynamic of the relationships. I think it's Zendaya's. She's been making this transition, obviously, for a while from teenage roles and even before that, kid roles, to young adult. And this is probably her most challenging, if you will, role. And she proves more than capable. All three of these actors have what I consider to be like old time in a good way, classic movie star appeal. They're great looking. They're charismatic. They're just interesting to watch. It's a beautifully filmed story. Great cinematography. Definitely one of the best movies of the year. It's called Challengers.
What happened surrounding the 2023 Kentucky Derby this year is really bad. 12 horses died at Churchill Downs.
People want to know why.
When the money's on the line, there's always going to be people looking to take an edge.
It's a win-now culture, and you see more horses dying.
We've got to get rid of all these drugs.
Nobody believed anybody was going to jail for this behavior.
This is the inflection point. If we don't act, it may be too late.
Also in the world of sport, and this is a very different story, it's a documentary. It's on FX and now streaming on Hulu. It's called Broken Horses. And we're just about, believe it or not, it's only 2 weeks until the Kentucky Derby. And this is very interesting. You might remember in recent years, there have been these clusters of deaths that Churchill Downs had about something like over the course of a couple of weeks, about 10 horses breaking down right on the track. There were some very high profile cases. It's been happening at other tracks as well. And there's nothing, you know, it's so heartbreaking when you see these beautiful animals right on the track. In some cases, you know, about to win a race or down the stretch, and they just crumple and the jockey's thrown. And you fear, of course, for the safety of the jockey. When they run out, when a crew runs out with a tarp, with a black or a blue or a green tarp, and they put it around the horse, you know, in most likelihood, either the horse is going to be put into an ambulance and taken away, or it's going to be euthanized on the spot. And this documentary, Broken Horses, I want to give kudos to the New York Times, Melissa Harper, Joe Drape, Rachel Abrams, Liz Day, the reporters who spearheaded the work on this. And they look into what's happening with these horses. And as you're probably not going to be surprised to find out, it has to do with greed. It has to do with the thirst for power. The purses have gone up so much in the last generation in horse racing. The breeding fees are incredible. So a lot of times, as you do with any athletes, and horses are athletes, they have joint pain. You look at the size of these horses and how thin their legs are and how much weight is on them. And then certain veterinarians and certain trainers, a very small minority, but they're there, will use illegal methods to mask the pain, which is very dangerous because then the horse doesn't know. The horse can't communicate how it's feeling. It happens with athletes of all kinds. You take a painkiller and then you can't feel something, and then you pull a muscle or something much worse because you can't feel it begin to stress and strain. And in the case of one of these horses, all four legs, there was stress on certain joints that the horse shouldn't even been racing. And then when it went out there, unfortunately, it collapsed and died. It's called Broken Horses. It's a one-off. It's about a little more than an hour documentary. It's sometimes tough to watch, but I think it's a valuable piece of journalism. Okay, let's stop there. Check out Challengers in theaters. Check out Broken Horses. Everybody relax. Don't bother Alec Baldwin or any Belson coffee shops. Enjoy the Taylor Swift album if you're into it. I'm Richard Roper. Thanks to everybody. We'll talk again soon.